what I'm understanding here, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're not giving me any money, so now I'm left basically with nothing. I'm left with zero, which what can I do with zero? You know, what can I can't do anything with it. I need to, this is my life here we're talking about. We're not just talking about, you know, something else. We're talking about my life, you know, and it's forcing me to do something I don't want to do, to leave. To go out and just leave and go home and say, make a clean cut here and say, no way, Corky, you're not putting up with these people. And I'll tell you why I can't put up with you people, because you're bastard people.
Christopher Guest in the theater spoof Waiting for Guffman. Money is always a battleground in the theater, but there's some real drama right now in L.A. Some stage actors are fighting with their union over whether the smallest theaters should have to pay minimum wage. So we'll have that story coming up later in the show. First, more violent crime in Los Angeles, up 27% across the city so far this year compared to the same period last year. And the biggest spike has been in aggravated assaults. The neighborhood that's seen the biggest jump is in and around Skid Row. There, violent crime's gone up 73%. That's nearly three times more than the rest of the city. Steve Soboroff is president of the Los Angeles Police Commission, which oversees and sets policy for the LAPD, and he's here now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, let's start with the citywide number. Violent crime up nearly 30% so far this year. What are the big drivers behind that?
Variables. The 27% number is the result of a perfect storm of a number of things, some of which can be as basic as reclassification of crimes. Things that weren't reported before are now being reported, but an inordinate amount having to do with drugs, gang violence, in Skid Row, lack of services, number of people with mental illness that are in the streets, number of people being let out of jail earlier, number of people not being crime reclassification where people aren't arrested for certain kinds of crimes. So this is, you know, these are perfect storms.
But you're not saying that the Skid Row issue is driving up violent crime for the whole city, are you?
Well, of course not. No, but you mentioned that the numbers there were higher than the increased numbers
right. There
were higher than other areas of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So that would have to do, would you say, with Proposition 47, which was approved last November, and that basically reclassifies felony crimes as misdemeanors, basically transferring cases to the county level and putting more people, getting more people out of jail, and also realignment, which got more people out of state prison.
Well, I think there's so much attention on making people who are in jail comfortable that the rest of us are being less comfortable.
What do you mean by that?
People are getting out of jail, early. Because of overcrowding and because of these, because of some of these measures, when some of them shouldn't, people are not being arrested when some of them should, and while they're in jail, how are they being prepared to get out and not go back? Recidivism rate is very high. So, when you compound that with, you know, relatively inexpensive drugs. And the kinds of positive reinforcement people get for going into gangs, it's no wonder. But I mean, I want to talk about solutions, not about the problems.
Well, okay, we have about a minute and a half left. Tell me one big solution that you would like to put forward.
There are service providers in Los Angeles, Boys and Girls Clubs, Big Brothers, drug rehab programs, job programs, that have the infrastructure to service double the number of people that they're servicing that are not funded, that but for funds can't do what they need to do. And I think that, the general, there is no middle class left right now, but the people above the line, there are way too many people below the line, but the few that are above the line need to focus, I believe, and understand the priority of helping these service providers to serve more people and being supportive of them. And, you know, maybe we go out to dinner less once a month less, or take one day off our vacation, or buy one less piece of artwork. But these service providers have the ability to serve and help people, and we need them. And I think that's a big solution. Certainly at the police department, we have many, many proactive community projects going on to try and help at risk and ill people.
Steve Soboroff, president of the LA Police Commission, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Well, let's talk about a windfall some of these service providers received. About 30 organizations in Skid Row found out they're receiving $100,000 donations, not from Oprah, not from David Geffen, but from a man named Delmer Clarence Kahlberg. Los Angeles Times columnist Steve Lopez is here to talk about this mystery man. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Madeline. How are you?
I'm good. Well, who is this Mr. Kahlberg?
Well, this is a guy from Minnesota, born in 1914, who served in World War II on the USS Ticonderoga, which was hit by kamikaze pilots, and he suffered some hearing loss. And after the war, settled in Los Angeles, a little house on National Boulevard in Mar Vista, and became a lawyer for the Veterans Administration, and raised a family, and was always kind of, influenced by his family's experiences during the Depression. His father died right before the Great Depression, and he and his three siblings and mother really struggled through it. And he kind of went through life with this idea that one way or another, he wanted to help what he referred to as the little guy. And he did that in his role as an attorney for the Veterans Administration. And that job sometimes took him to Skid Row, where he was looking for destitute veterans who needed legal representation. And what happened was that family situation, there was no Ozzie and Harriet deal. The marriage broke up. The father became estranged from the son. And he lived pretty much like a hermit in that house for most of his adult life, and was socking away money. And nobody knew this. His son didn't even know it. And upon his death about a year and a half ago, the son discovered that his father, his adoptive father, had amassed a small fortune.
And he was just a lawyer. So, I mean, not just a lawyer, but a lawyer, not a fancy pants lawyer. He was a lawyer for the VA. So he wasn't earning a lot of money. So, and this donation, as you wrote about, is more than $3 million. So how did he get all this money?
Well, according to the son, Jeffrey, who happens to be an associate dean, he became a musician and teaches and is an administrator at Penn, University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. He didn't know either. I mean, they had been estranged for many years. And what he found when he looked through his father's papers was that he would buy and hold stocks going back decades. Like he'd buy Exxon, he'd buy Standard, and he'd just sit on it. And one of the things that he did alone in that little house, he never had another relationship, never remarried, was that he would kind of keep these little notes about various investments. And what's interesting is that he lived so frugally. Here he was putting together this portfolio and spending nothing. And in fact, when the son first went back to reunite with him, after his father had taken a fall and they decided to give their relationship another try, he described the house as a time capsule. He had left in 1973, and he said it was the same wallpaper, the same furniture, the same paint on the walls. And here was his dad, and he started to look through these papers and realize, oh, my God, my dad's a multimillionaire and won't spend a nickel to go out for a cup of coffee.
Wow. And so he left a will, and he said basically most of this money goes to Skid Row.
He gave some money to his son. He gave some money to your old employer, KCET, apparently, while he was...
And your old employer.
Yes, apparently while he was holed up there in his house, he watched a lot of SoCal Connected.
Oh, well, that's good.
And so he gave them a big check. He wrote a $500,000 check to the Veterans Administration, and he appears in his old age to have lost track of exactly how much money he had. And so what he said in the last paragraph of the will was, whatever's left over should go to Skid Row agencies. But he gave no specifics on that. And so his son didn't know quite how to handle that, nor did the attorney, Ted Wolfberg, who decided to just start researching. And he found about 30 Skid Row agencies, and it came to $3.3 million. And so divided up, they each get a little over $100,000.
So what's the reaction from these agencies? I mean, this is a very unexpected gift, I imagine.
Yeah, manna from heaven. And, you know, you're talking there about Skid Row and what are the drivers of crime.
Yeah.
In my experience, the main driver is that we know what works, but we don't fund it adequately. And what works better than anything is permanent supportive housing. And that's not just a roof over somebody's head, but it's all of the necessary rehab and mental health counseling services and job connections. We know it works. We've promised that we're going to do it. Here's Hilda Solis, the supervisor, saying again, we need regional centers. I heard all of that in 2006. None of them ever materialized. But they struggle, each and every one of these organizations that do this good and noble work, to raise money, and most of it is donations. And so, you know, he hit all of the big operations like the Union Rescue Mission and the Midnight and Lamp Community. And then some smaller ones, too. And, you know, for a smaller operation like Inner City Arts, which has a smallish budget, $100,000 is a big infusion. And so, you know, I talked to people there who were just delighted with this. And so, too, was the Downtown Women's Center and some of the others I spoke to. This is unexpected, and it's from a man they never met. And here now he'll have this legacy of impacting quite a few lives on Skid Row.
What was he like personally? I mean, you mentioned that he was estranged from his son. Why were they estranged?
That was the part of the story that actually interested me the most. And, you know, I had a long talk with the son. And here, the son's mother married this guy. So this is his adoptive father. Mm-hmm. And then when the marriage breaks up, and the son comes of age and moves away, he kind of aligns with his mother, who resettles in North Carolina, and doesn't have much to do with the father, who they just didn't see eye to eye on much of anything. And so, you know, he made over the years a few attempts to try to put some kind of a relationship back together, and the father just kind of rebuffed him. I think he was an angry guy, and maybe also driven further into isolation by his increased hearing loss from this this injury aboard the USS Ticonderoga. He lived in his own world, and he didn't connect with anybody, including family. And only when he took a fall and landed in the hospital did Jeffrey, his son, find out in Philadelphia that some of the hospital personnel said that told him, hey, he's talking about you. He's boasting about you. He knows about your accomplishments. And he decided to give it another try. And so he flew out to L.A. from Philadelphia. They sat down in that house, and they began to, you know, redevelop their relationship. It was, you know, something that Jeffrey, the son, now really appreciates, you know, having had the chance to reconnect before his father died.
Well, Steve, thanks. That was a great story.
It was, you know, it's kind of heartwarming. It's sad in some ways. But yeah. Here's a guy who, until the end and even beyond, sticking out for the little guy.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Steve Lopez, LA Times columnist. Definitely read his column if you get a chance at the LA Times website. We've been talking about Delmer Clarence Kahlberg, who gave $3.3 million to various charities on Skid Row. And we would definitely like to hear from you if you'd like to weigh in on what you think is the best way to fight crime and to solve the problems on Skid Row. Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Facebook, KCRW Press Play, or you can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, the city of Los Angeles may now have to pay more than $1 billion to restore the LA River. That's a lot for a city that's already stretched. The future of the LA River next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Last year, the Army Corps of Engineers decided to recommend a $1 billion restoration plan for the cement flood control channel, otherwise known as the LA River. The proposal said the city would pay half and the feds would pay half. The plan would restore habitat, widen the river, create wetlands, and provide access points and bike trails along an 11-mile stretch north of downtown. But since then, the price tag for the plan has gone up, and the Army Corps now says the city will be on the hook for most of it. One city councilman, Mitch O'Farrell, has been involved in the development of the LA River Restoration Plan for many years. He chairs a committee that's trying to figure out how to pay for the plan, and he's on the line now. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Madeline. It's good to be on.
Well, it's nice to have you. And I understand the city council is scheduled to vote today on whether to tell the federal government that the city can pay for this plan or not. And so what's going to happen?
So we already did the vote. It was unanimous. Okay. And it was unanimous because the work that my office and I did since finding out about the escalated match request in January was we worked with the city engineer to amend the report that reserves the right for us to seek further consideration after this juncture. So we were able to satisfy the requirements with the Army Corps of Engineers for the purpose of adopting this report in June and making sure that it becomes part of the general's report that goes to Congress in the fall.
So what does that mean, if you could boil it down? Does that mean that the city will go forward with it?
And what we've done is we have worked out the agreement in such a way that gives the city the flexibility it needs so that when real projects actually begin to cascade in the coming years, that we will be able to fund and match on a project-by-project basis. Now, the background here is that the city is continuing negotiations during this process that will get us closer to a 50-50 match. That's what we're all hopeful for, but I am certainly not prepared to commit the city to be on the hook for $1 billion. The agreement that we all made back in the fall of 2013 was, as you stated, that it was about a $1 billion project spread out over decades, that we, the city, would be responsible for about half of that, again, spread out in the coming decades. And we based that strong commitment on the fact that over the past 20 years, we've demonstrated the ability to raise money locally, and we've raised several hundred million dollars, actually, for projects along the river so far. So past is prologue. We know how to get matching dollars to create things for the city, and we felt that it was agreeable to meet the federal government halfway. Mm-hmm. That dynamic has now changed.
Well, how did it change, and why?
Well, basically, the Army Corps of Engineers is saying that for some of these projects that are in the plan, that the city is responsible for land acquisition, remediation, and relocation for what might be happening on that property. That escalated the price considerably based on the Army Corps' basically their determination, their feelings that the city would be responsible for all of that piece of it. And then the federal match would come in for just the actual projects that we complete. The previous understanding was that it would be 50-50 for everything we do. That is what has changed that was brought to my attention in early January.
But can they unilaterally change it? Isn't this an agreement you both sign?
Well, no, not yet. The agreement was in principle, and mind you, it was after meeting with the Obama administration, after meeting with General Bostic of the Army Corps of Engineers, after meeting with the EPA, and after meeting with both U.S. senators. and several of our congressional leaders, the agreement was on the table. And it was it's since that time, over the course of about a year, leading up to in December of this last year, that the ground has shifted underneath us, if you will. So the hope is that through further negotiations, we'll get back closer to the 50-50 match. If that doesn't happen, we are not on the hook to commit that type of funding.
All right, let's talk about land acquisition and relocation. What does that mean? Where is this land, and what are you relocating?
There are several important parcels in this Alternative 20 vision. One of them is the Union Pacific Rail Yard, and that price tag is upwards of $700 million that the city of L.A. would be responsible for almost completely. That project alone helps drive the cost up considerably. There's another parcel in North Atwater Village that would also require acquisition, probable cleanups, remediation, mm-hmm. and then relocation of that business as well. Now, we can't all look into the crystal ball and determine what's going to happen 5, 10, 15, 20, even 30 years out. So I think that the agreement that my colleagues supported unanimously today is one that has the flexibility we need while these negotiations are happening, leading into the General's report in October.
Well, I would imagine that this particular area is looking pretty good to real estate developers. Are they also crowding in and trying to buy up parts of this land?
Very much so. I mean, since I've been on the council for 21 months now, and the speculation in my district, especially in Elysian Valley, is really high. There's all sorts of interest along the river because, you know, real estate professionals and developers have their eye on the river because they know that we're about to invest resources in improving it, which is why in my particular community of Elysian Valley, we are enacting some land use measures that will help protect the existing sort of built environment there, so that that will play a role in giving the community a say, a more direct say in its immediate future. And I think we need to really approach the future of the river in that sense, neighborhood by neighborhood, while we're cobbling together the resources to actually fulfill this vision.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if that speculation is also driving up the price of the land that you have to pay for.
Well, so far, we're just dealing with Union Pacific, and they are tough customers. And so, you know, they are very well aware of what we're doing. They are not, you know, they're a privately held company. And so, you know, we've had mixed success over the decades in dealing with them. So we know that, you know, their price has gone up. And we should expect that with all this interest that over the, you know, coming years, prices will escalate. So we have to have some sort of flexibility built into that too.
So this restoration plan is massive, and it's estimated to take decades, 30 to 50 years to,
yes.
to complete. Has any of the work started yet? And what is the overall vision for this?
So the vision is very ambitious. And I invite anyone listening to go on LARiver.org to take a look at the master plan. It was adopted in 2007. And as you mentioned, it's up to a 50-year vision to be fulfilled. We're already, we've already been approaching that vision. We're doing one project at a time here and there on an ad hoc basis. And I'll give you a few examples of that, are that my office has directed the city to take a look at what it would look like to reimagine the Central Service Yard in Atwater Village near Chevy Chase Park, for example. That's prime LA real estate that the city owns next to the river. So projects like that that we have immediate control over, we're already looking at in terms of helping, you know, return river adjacent properties into open space, parkland, public space. We are working on and funding pedestrian bridges. So we're working on the vision now. We have been for some time. But what I'm looking for at the local level, what we have control over, and what I've introduced legislation of, is enhanced increment financing for the river. That's something that we can do locally, and that is a new law that we have been provided, the governor signed last year. The city council, through my direction, again, unanimously supported moving forward with establishing a district along the river. And this is good on many levels. It's not a tax increase. It's simply capturing some of the dollars in incremental increases in property tax collections and reinvesting them locally. And we can do things like infrastructure improvements. We can create low and moderate housing, low income and moderate income housing. You know, we have a housing crisis. Mm-hmm. I've said all along that as we improve the river, that we don't want to leave our constituents behind who have lived there for decades, sometimes generations. As we move forward, I want to make sure that the vision is comprehensive, and it isn't all about creating only open space. It isn't all about just having investment of big projects, but we're also reinvesting in the human capital that lives along the Los Angeles River. A quarter of the residents in LA, 1 million people, live within 1 mile of the 31 miles of the LA River. So that's a lot of people. That's a huge potential, and we really need to look at this very carefully as we move forward.
Councilman Mitch O'Farrell, representing LA's 13th District. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Madeline. Had a good time.
All right, we want to know what you think. Do you ever hang out by or on the LA River? Are you hoping to see it restored? Would you be willing to pay more in property taxes to see that happen? Reach out on our Facebook page or on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, a new Hollywood movie tells the story of a Jewish woman's fight to get her family's paintings stolen by the Nazis from Austria. She hired a young lawyer who had no experience in international law. He won. I'll speak with him about how he did it after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A new film comes out next week about stolen art by the Nazis and one woman's decade-long fight to retrieve it from the Austrian government. Woman in Gold tells the story of Maria Altman. She was the niece of Adele Bloch-Bauer, the subject of one of Gustav Klimt's most famous works. It's really a stunning painting. Adele's dark hair and serene face atop a waterfall of gold.
Here she is, my aunt, Adele. Painted by Gustav Klimt.
That's quite a painting.
She was taken off the walls of our home by the Nazis. And since then, she's been hanging in the Belvedere Gallery in Vienna.
And now you'd like to be reunited.
Wouldn't that be lovely?
Helen Mirren plays the elderly Maria Altman, who fought for years to get the painting back from the Austrians, even getting her case heard before the U.S. Supreme Court. Ryan Reynolds plays her attorney, Randall Schoenberg. It seems like a historical drama. The war, after all, was so long ago, but it is still being fought over in the courts. The real Randall Schoenberg has continued to work to recover stolen art. He's president of the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust, and he's here now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, it's nice to have you. It's incredible that just a few weeks ago, the Austrian government refused to return a Gustav Klimt fresco to the heirs of a man named Erich Lederer.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, how many more cases are there out there now?
Oh, it's sort of endless because there's so much property that was taken, you know, along with the murder of 6 million people and devastation of all of those families. When you talk about artworks and significant artworks, then it's in the tens of thousands, maybe, that are still missing and unaccounted for.
And are there active legal battles happening?
Sure. There's one even in Los Angeles. I call them the two most stolen paintings in America are at the Norton Simon Museum. If you ever watched Desperate Housewives in the beginning, they had that Adam and Eve that sort of split apart. That Adam and Eve is by Lucas Cranach the Elder, a very famous German painter. And they were owned by a Jewish family in Holland named Jacques Houtsticker, that was the dealer. And he fled. His paintings were taken by Hermann Göring, who's the number two Nazi after Hitler. He actually died fleeing from Europe. He fell off a boat mysteriously and drowned, and his family is now claiming them back. That case has been going on for years. The museum is fighting always with procedural arguments. It's the statute of limitations. It's the act of state doctrine. It's all of these procedural arguments because there's no defense on the merits. The paintings were taken by Hermann Göring and never given back. So the paintings need to be returned, and I continue to work on a lot of these cases.
So tell us about your first case, and this is the famous case.
Right.
Maria Altman found you. Was it 1998?
1998, yeah. Maria was my grandmother's best friend, and my grandmother had died in the 80s, so about 10 years before. And
Your grandfather, it has to be said, was the composer Arthur Schoenberg.
My grandfather on my other side.
Arnold, rather.
Right. My grandfather on my dad's side is Arnold Schoenberg. Maria was friends with my mom's parents, Eric and Trudit Zeisel. Eric Zeisel's also a composer, also a very good composer from Austria, and all my grandparents fled the Nazis and came here to Los Angeles in the 30s and early 40s. So my parents grew up here. So Maria called me after Austria had passed a new law that allowed for restitution of some works that were in federal art museums in Austria. And that was the result of a great piece of investigative journalism by a man named Hubertus Czernin. And Maria found out about this and called me. I was the grandson of her old friend, and she knew I was a lawyer, and so she asked me to help
her. But you didn't specialize in this.
Oh, no. I was working downtown at a big firm and doing litigation and securities litigation and partnership disputes and contract disputes and things like that. I had never done anything involving artworks and international law and any of those issues.
Oh, my gosh. And now this is what you do.
Yeah, well, I did it for a long time for Maria. The case took 8 years. And by the end of it, I knew something about the field, I guess.
Yeah. And you went before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah. So ultimately, when the Austrians refused to return the paintings under this law, we had to figure out what to do. And it was just too expensive to file a lawsuit in Austria, which is, you know, the first thing you would have thought that she would do. But I looked at the law here in the United States, and I thought, you know, maybe she can file a lawsuit here. She's been living in Los Angeles for 60 years. Why not? And so I looked at the law very naively and thought, okay, let's do it. And my firm was not interested, so I left the big firm and I opened up my own office pretty close here in Wilshire and Bundy, and I filed a lawsuit against the Republic of Austria. So that case went up to the Supreme Court on the issue of whether we could actually do that. Because there's something called the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which says you can't sue a foreign government, but it has some exceptions. And we were trying to use one of these exceptions, and that issue went to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And you won, obviously.
Yeah, with spoiler alert. Yes. I won in the Supreme Court. Yeah, no one thought that would happen. Even I was not overly optimistic and just wanted to, I hoped that at least one justice would rule in our favor. But we got 6 out of 9, and that's a victory. And so we were allowed to go along ahead with the case. We hadn't won anything, really. It was just the right to go ahead with the case. And so it took another couple of years.
And what were the Austrians arguing? What were they saying was the reason they needed to keep the painting?
Well, their claim was based on the will that was left behind by Maria's aunt, the woman in the picture, Adele Bloch-Bauer. She died very young in 1925. She was just 43 years old. She developed meningitis, and this is before penicillin, so she sort of died in a matter of days. And she left behind a handwritten will that asked her husband to give the paintings to the museum when he died. So the Austrian government claimed, well, that means that we own it and it was willed to us by Adele Bloch-Bauer. The problem for them was that this was phrased in a way that made it really not binding. It was just a request of her husband. And one important fact that they left out was that after Adele died, Maria's father, who was the lawyer for the family, submitted a document saying that the paintings actually didn't belong to her but belonged to her husband. So she was just asking her husband to do something when he died. But of course, the paintings were stolen from him before he died. And so he never gave the paintings to the Austrian gallery, but wrote a will leaving his estate to his niece, Maria Altman, and another niece and nephew.
So she eventually gets the painting back from the Austrians. It is to a great fanfare, I remember, back in 2006.
2006, right, yeah.
Right, it's shown at LACMA for a short period of time, and then she sold it to Ronald Lauder.
Right, so we actually recovered 5 paintings by Gustav Klimt, and we brought them very quickly to LA County Museum of Art, and Maria and her family were there again with these paintings in one room, just like they had been in her uncle's home. And that was very moving. So ultimately, the paintings then went on display at the Neue Gallery, which is a small German and Austrian art museum that Ronald Lauder helped establish in New York. And Ronald Lauder then decided to, he wanted to purchase the famous gold portrait, the really most valuable of the five paintings. And so the family agreed to sell it to him on the condition that it be on permanent display in that museum. And so that's where it is today.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Randall Schoenberg. He is an LA-based attorney who specializes in recovering stolen art by the Nazis during World War II. Any irony that this particular painting was used as a symbol of Austria, of Austrian art, and this is a Jewish woman, portrait of a Jewish woman?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So Adele is part of this group of Jews who were able to move into Vienna at the end of the 19th century, so before 1900. You have to go into sort of the history of Austria. Austria actually said that Jews weren't allowed inside Austria for a long period of time. There were only a few thousand living in Vienna as recently as about 1850. Jews did not get full civil rights in Austria until 1867, which is after the U.S. Civil War, just to give you a context. And Gustav Klimt started out as an academic painter, getting commissions from the Kaiser, right, from the government. Mm-hmm. And then he became a little bit too dangerous, a little poked his finger at too many people in power. And so he was thrown out of the academy and set up something called the Secession, which was sort of a separate art movement. And then he didn't like those people and just went out on his own. And who were his supporters? These Jewish families, the Blochbauers, the Lederers, the Zuckerkandels. He painted maybe 100 major works between 1900 and 1918 when he died in the flu epidemic. And a third of those were bought just by those three Jewish families and, of course, many others. So a lot of his subjects who sat for him, like Adele Blochbauer, were Jewish. This was a problem then for the Nazis during the Nazi time, because they really loved Klimt, but it's the pictures of all of these Jewish women, right? So they had to sort of hide that fact, and they changed the names, and they would say it's portrait of a woman or woman in gold instead of saying the woman, the sitter's name. The name of the sitter was erased. And so your question was, is it sort of ironic that this becomes the icon of Austrian art? And the answer is yes, it is a little bit. But it's understandable given the contribution that Jews made to the art and culture of Vienna at that time.
And so now, in 2015, are the Austrians open about that? Have they come to terms with that, with the fact that this is this painting, and in fact, lots of Klimt's paintings are, you know, their birthright, and are they open about the contradiction and the irony?
I think so. I think many Austrians are aware of the history. And Austria is now a tiny country, mm-hmm. right? It's not the center of a big empire. And they realize that in many ways their better days are behind them, and they were this sort of pre-war era when they had the influence of all of these different cultures that came into Vienna, including the Jewish contributions. And so there are many people in Vienna who are not only aware of it, but really work very hard at promoting understanding and education about the contributions that Jews and or Klimt, who wasn't Jewish but who was supported by Jewish clients, made to what is now considered Austrian culture. So I found many Austrians who are very receptive to that.
So how do they square the fact that in this latest case, with you mentioned Lederer, that they refused to give him his painting? I know that they're relying on another kind of legal argument, but in the broader sense, there is the justice argument.
There's a line in the movie Woman in Gold, which is coming out next week, where my character, the Randy character, says, you know, there are two Austrias. There's one that opposes restitution and justice for the victims, and another Austria that really is in favor of it. And that's something that I actually had written, that the writer Alexei K. Campbell turned into this speech, because it was my experience also. There are people like the journalist Hubertus Czernin, who really played a crucial role in the whole thing, who are very much in favor of doing the right thing and giving things back. And there are still people in Austria who want to hold on to whatever they have, regardless of how that might look and what that means for justice and restitution. So there's this tension still in Austria today.
Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Very welcome. I hope everybody likes the film. It obviously means a lot to me, and it I think Maria would have really loved it. She passed away, unfortunately, a few years ago. But I think for both of us, telling the story was such a huge part of this. And now to have so many people able to see it in a film is just it's a dream. It's great.
And Ryan Reynolds plays you.
That's
an extra bonus.
It's a little bit of an extra bonus. Everybody plays that game, who should play you if they ever made a movie. And it says radio, so no one can see me. But Ryan Reynolds isn't exactly what comes to mind when people look at me. Sexiest man alive is not really how I would look at myself.
You've just a few years on him, but other than that. Randall Schoenberg, LA-based attorney. He specializes in recovering art stolen by the Nazis during World War II, and his work with Maria Altman recovering her family's paintings by Gustav Klimt is the subject of a new film. It's called Woman in Gold, and it opens next Wednesday. Warren Olney, who would play you in the movie version?
Somebody young and handsome.
Of course. Debonair. Matt Holzman.
They could play against type.
What's coming up at 1 o'clock?
Well, we're going to be talking about the fact that political polarization has now reached the Supreme Court, in case anybody doubted it. But in the case of the coal industry versus the EPA in a battle over the regulation of coal-fired power plants, we have 20 states siding with the coal industry and 17 states, including California, siding with the EPA. It's just a very interesting way that things have broken down. We're also going to be talking about something very interesting with Tom Burgess of the Financial Times. If you think Africa is rising, you know, that term is used all the time. He's got a book called The Looting Machine, Warlords, Oligarchs, Corporations, Smugglers, and the Theft of Africa's Wealth. He's a great interview. It's worth hearing.
Okay, yeah, and that's nothing new in terms of looting that continent.
Well, that's true, but right. It goes against this idea of Africa's rising, which is also true because there has been enormous investment and economic advancement for certain elites.
Okay, look forward to that at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up before that on this program, the surprisingly bitter fight over whether actors should be paid a minimum wage for performing in small theaters here in L.A. That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. And now, a strange stage fight over actors' salaries in the theater. Actors Equity, the union that represents stage actors and managers, wants L.A. small theaters to start paying the minimum wage. Since the 1970s, these 99-seat theaters have been operating with a waiver from the union, and this enabled them really to proliferate across the city. Members of the union began voting today on the new agreement. It's divided the theater community. And joining me now to talk about this is Anthony Burns. He's commentator on KCRW, and you can hear him every Tuesday on his segment, Opening the Curtain. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Madeline.
Thanks for joining us for free here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Today on Press Play. So give us a history here. Since the 1970s, these theaters have had a waiver?
Yeah. So, you know, normally when we hear about, you know, a union battle, we think on one side of the, you know, corporation on one side and the worker on the other. And so that falls into a kind of familiar stereotype. But to understand what's going on here, we have to go back to the 80s and, as you said, even back further to the 70s, right? And this is the result of a group of actors approaching their own union here in Los Angeles, right, their national union, but LA actors coming and saying, hey, we want the right to practice our craft in small theaters here in Los Angeles. Will you give us a waiver? This is back in the 70s.
And the idea being, otherwise we couldn't do this because the theater, the producers just can't afford to pay scale.
Well, see, here when we talk about producer, this is where it gets trickier because it's not just actors against their own union. It's the fact that the folks we would expect to be sitting across the table, the theater owners or producers are most often actors, right? It's most often the guy in the room who got the, you know, short straw, or the actor who happens to be good at Excel ends up being, okay, you're the producer, right? So this is a question of actors against their own union. And while this dates back to the 70s, the kind of kerfuffle we're in right now is the result of a settlement to a lawsuit, again, of actors against their own union back in the 80s that created this 99-seat plan, which basically said, you know, if you're in a theater that's smaller than 99 seats, union actors can come and perform there, not for a wage, but as volunteers and for a stipend. And now the union has come back, lo these many years later, and said, wait a minute, we want this to be different. We want everyone to make a minimum wage. And by making it minimum wage, they've kind of introduced this idea that makes it really tough to see through to what's sort of actually going on here. So you have one group of folks who are sort of saying, we want the right to practice our art, and we're, you know, we're volunteers and we want to volunteer our time. And then another group of folks saying, hey, no, we're a labor union, and we, you know, our job is to support minimum wage and to support our members making more money.
Are there people in the union who actually support the union's stance on this?
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. There are folks on both sides of this. I think when we look at this, we have to think that Equity is a national union, right? And there are folks across the country, and there have been for years and years and years, who sort of look at LA and say, hey, wait a minute, why do they get to do this for free? And, you know, we're getting paid. Wait a minute, they're eroding our power as a union, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, though, if judging by the outcry, and we can argue about why that is, but judging from the outcry, the majority of actors in Los Angeles, union actors, seem to be against this. Now, what we're in right now is those actors in Los Angeles County, because of the settlement back in the 80s, are now voting up or down on this plan. And they have this vote that is not really binding about whether to adopt this new plan. And I say not really binding because the kind of mechanics of this are they're voting whether to accept their union's plan or not. But regardless of their vote, it's not going to be binding. It's the next vote, which is of this smaller sort of national council of equity folks. Those 80 folks' votes later in April is the one that apparently is really going to make the difference.
Okay. So basically, it's a PR battle right now for those 80 votes.
Very much so.
And Tim Robbins has been very vocal. Helen Mirren, some big names.
Yeah. Noah Wiley came out against this.
This is all against this. Yeah. And then on the face of it, you look at it and you go, well, you guys don't need minimum wage. You don't need anything. You're rich actors.
Right. I mean, no one's going to make money in 99-seat theater, minimum wage or not, right? Because this, even if this were minimum wage, it's not going to be a 40-hour work week once you get into performance, et cetera. So the debate here, or the question here, really is this a job or is this an art form, right? Mm-hmm. Is this a group of folks volunteering for a nonprofit, or is this a group of folks who are workers or employees in a money-making enterprise? 99-seat theater is a lot of things. What it isn't is a money-making enterprise.
Because even if you sell out, you're not making money.
Yeah, even if you sell out, I mean, and again, to kind of step way back on this, across the country, nonprofit theaters only make 50% of their money from ticket sales. The other, they're dependent, because they're nonprofits, right, on donations and fundraising, right, funders, et cetera. So if you have a sellout house, you've only done half your job.
So it's not about necessarily exploitation of labor.
No, because it's, again, it would be exploitation of, well, I won't say whether it's exploitation of labor or not, but it's interesting that you have a lot of actors who are the folks who are saying, hey, it's our choice to be here. You don't have to do this. We want the right to do it. Don't stand in our way. So it would seem to be, if the workers are asking to be let in, that makes the exploitation of labor argument a little tricky.
So what happens? Play it out. What happens if they do indeed adopt this and forbid 99-seat theaters from paying nothing and enforce the minimum wage rule? What happens to the theater scene, the small
right.
theater
so,
scene?
Right. So the real question here is, because this isn't, you know, because this isn't a kind of traditional union argument where there's a fat cat sitting on a bunch of money, and where you're talking about that these theaters are theaters that are losing money and are depending on donations to continue existing, the question is either A, their capacity to raise more money, or their appetite for how much money are they willing to lose before they shut their doors, right? So I think the unfortunate part of this is, a lot of the theaters that are doing the most interesting work are probably the ones who are most likely to shut down. You know, will theater at this level, you know, cease and desist instantly? No. There's going to be 99-seat theater. Will it be non-union? Yeah, probably a lot of it will. Will there be some union actors who maybe don't call their union or do this thing called FICOR in order to be able to perform? Yeah, there will. Will there be some good theaters that go out of business because of this? Yeah, there will. It's more of an ecosystem question.
Anthony Burns, so great to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks for explaining all that to us. And you can hear more of Anthony Burns on his weekly segment on KCRW on Tuesdays. It's called Opening the Curtain. Christian Bordahl is here, sitting in for the ailing Jolie Myers to give us some feedback. Hello.
Hello. To be or not to be, Madeline, that is the question.
Wow. It is good that you have a day job. Just saying.
You don't think I'm ready for the 99-seat theaters even? Not,
I don't know.
Not to be paid anything? Madeline,
maybe.
So hard on me.
Back right. Of the house.
Well, we got a lot of passionate feedback about that 99-seat theater topic mm-hmm. that you were just talking to Anthony about. Leo Mark says, I'm a proud equity member who works in both fancy regional theaters and scrappy 99-seat houses here in L.A. My union's proposal would simply destroy what we've spent decades nourishing in this city. And the painful part is, there's no reason to do it this way. And Ariana Ortiz agreed with him. She said people don't understand the 99-seat plan and why so many actors are taking a stand to save it. If a company can afford to pay actors, they should. And I wish Actors Equity would be focusing on that and creating livable wages for the very few equity houses already on the West Coast, or creating more opportunities for LA actors to audition for regional theaters around the country. And I have to quote the great Hal Holbrook also, who says this is the dumbest idea he's come across in a long time. Says you'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind to think they could pay regular union wages and stay open, these theaters. Get real. This is how you get seen. You get on the stage and they don't pay you what they can't pay you, and they give you a stage to act on. So
all the world is one.
There you go.
All right. Christian Bordahl, thank you
sure.
very much. To the Point with Warren Olney is up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.